We interrupt to bring you this.
You've connected with a worldwide network of millions. You're on TalkZone.com, Internet Talk Radio.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Hi, this is Hub Arkish, along with Eric Edholm and the entire editorial staff of Pro Football Weekly. It's our pleasure to welcome you to this week's edition of the show, where every week we bring you all the news, scoops, and rumors from around the NFL before they happen.
We'll head up to Green Bay to find out what Roger Goodell said to the Packers. We've got Terrell Owens in Cincinnati as training camps are set to open.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. I'm Hub Arkish, the publisher and editor, along with senior editor Eric Edholm here in the studio. And we have the great pleasure in our opening segment to be joined by your regular host of this show next week, Wayne Larrabee, voice of the Green Bay Packers, will be back in the host's chair. But right now we've got him out on the road, training camp to training camp, where I'll be starting tomorrow. And Wayne was in Green Bay today for the annual Packers shareholders meeting. And I guess you'd say, Wayne, the guest of honor, so to speak, the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell. And apparently he had some interesting things to say about the status of collective bargaining with the players.
Well, you know, Hubba, it's kind of interesting. I don't think this was by chance that Roger Goodell just dropped into the Packers. I think there was some symbolism here in that he was coming to the smallest market in the NFL at a time, as we all know, that is very much in a state of flux in terms of the collective bargaining agreement. And I think he tried to make a point that Green Bay and the smaller markets of the NFL are very important in this process. And that's kind of what his presence said at the shareholders meeting in Green Bay this morning.
Wayne, you obviously know that the Packers are a unique team in that their records, their financial records, are public information because they are a publicly held team. So given the fact that, Green Bay's situation has become, sort of information that everyone is available to, and I know the union has said we're not going to extrapolate, the other 31 teams based on what the Packers have revealed, but how can you, did Goodell talk about that at all? Did he address that consideration at all?
Well, obviously that DeMaurice Smith mentioned that, hey, listen, the Packers numbers are out there, but that doesn't represent the other 31 teams in the league necessarily. But I think what the Packer numbers give you, Eric, is a little bit of a glimpse as to why the owners reopened the collective bargaining agreement. The Packers, for example, last year, their revenues were down by $11 million. Their operating profit was down $11 million from the previous year. Their player costs were up $22 million from the previous year. The Packers still managed a $5 million profit, but that was down from $20 million the previous year. So I think what the Green Bay numbers suggest is that there is a spiraling effect going on across the league here. Now, does that mean everybody's in the same boat? No, I don't think so. Obviously, some markets are doing better locally than others. The economy has hit some areas much harder than others. It certainly has hit the Midwest and certainly Wisconsin more so than it has other parts of the country. But nonetheless, I think in general, you have you get a glimpse with Green Bay numbers as to what the owners are all about here, and that, there's a trend going on that if this contract was left in place unabated, that the numbers could get pretty dark in a hurry.
Wayne, we know that Mark Murphy, the president of the Green Bay Packers, is a key member of the management council's negotiating team with the players. And I'm curious, in your listening to both Goodell and Murphy, any sense that with the loss at the Supreme Court level in seeking broader antitrust exemptions, that maybe the owner's stance has or will need to soften a little bit, and this lockout that we've all called a sure thing for 11 may not be such a sure thing anymore?
You know what? When you listen to the two gentlemen talk today, that's really the last thing they want to see is a lockout. Mark went through a number of them as a player and as a member of the union, their negotiating committee, earlier in his career, and that's the one thing he has maintained they cannot afford to do. I think in some of the rhetoric we've heard, especially recently, has been a little saber-rattling, so to speak, but by no means would I consider a lockout a lock to happen, so to speak. But by the same token, it's something that you're going to hear a lot about as we go forward. The commissioner did not address a lockout specifically, but from what he said, it's the last thing they want to do.
Yeah, Wayne, we've heard a lot about the 18-game schedule, the possibility of expanding the regular season by two games. Did Goodell address that at all today?
Yes, he did. The enhanced schedule is something that Roger Goodell has been championing now for a couple of years. He would like to see a reduction in preseason games to 2, an increase in regular season games to 18. Now, this would involve adjustments perhaps to the training schedule on the off season, some of the requirements the players might have. I would imagine it will also bring into play perhaps larger rosters, and certainly, I guess, a little more flexibility in terms of injuries. In other words, when a player goes on injured reserve, he's not lost for the rest of the season. But there's a point in time when he'll be able to come back onto the active roster if he's healthy. So I think all those things are up for debate, but those are factors that have come into play. And I know that the NFL would like to see it go to an 18-game schedule. They feel that 2 preseason games is enough and that the product really is hurting in the preseason. The fans don't want it. And they don't want 4 preseason games, and neither does the league.
Wayne, one more real quick question before we let you go. The Green Bay Packers, you'll be calling the games again this year. Hopes are sky high. In fact, in Pro Football Weekly's NFL Preview magazine, which is on sale at your local newsstands now, our writer's poll has picked the Green Bay Packers to win the Super Bowl. Are the expectations weighing on this Packer team? What's your sense as they get ready to open camp?
Well, you know, they had a very good offseason for the most part. I mean, the one distraction was losing Johnny Jolly, and believe me, on the field, that's going to be a fairly significant loss. He was a very good, rather unsung, but very good defensive lineman. Defensive end, he led the defensive line and tackles a year ago with 75. They need to make major improvements in their special teams. That's a huge question mark. They were 31st overall in special teams a year ago. Offensively and defensively, they feel they have some momentum. But again, as Ted Thompson said, their general manager said today, he said, we're not looking to be the youngest team in the NFL for a 4th straight year, and we expect to win this year. So yeah, I think the hope within the Packers family is every bit as high as it is outside.
All right, Wayne, thanks much for taking time out with us this week. We will look forward to having you right here back at the steering wheel next week hosting Pro Football Weekly. Right now, we take a quick commercial break, and then we're back with more NFL Way We Hear It right on the other side. Pro Football Weekly rolls on. Hub Arkish and Eric Edholm in the studio with you, and we now welcome in Executive Editor Dan Arkish. And Dan covers, amongst other teams and divisions, the NFC North. And, Dan, we just visited with Wayne Larrabee, the voice of the Packers, talked a little bit about their annual shareholders meeting and a quick overview of the Green Bay Packers, a quick reference to the year-long suspension of Johnny Jolly. But now we need you to take us in depth. What does it really mean to the defensive line hopes of the Green Bay Packers?
Well, Hub, Johnny Jolly actually did a very good job last year. You know, he led the defensive linemen on the team with 39 tackles, and he was a key force on what it turned out to be the top-ranked run defense. You know, very athletic guy, tremendous at batting down passes, and they're going to miss him, but his problems off the field, you know, have been lingering for a long time now, and it really appears as far back as the draft, they knew that Johnny Jolly could be in real trouble, potentially even career-threatening trouble. They drafted defensive end Mike Neal, and then in the middle of May, they made a switch, making B.J. Raji the starting nose tackle and moving Ryan Pickett over to Jolly's spot. So you kind of saw the handwriting on the wall, and they feel that they have enough manpower to overcome the loss of Jolly. Although, you know, like I said, he had a very good year.
Well, and here's where it all gets interesting, Dan. I think everybody knows Raji was drafted with a top 10 pick eventually to be the starting nose tackle. Has shown flashes, if he can stay in shape, that he'll be maybe even an improvement there. But you look at Ryan Pickett, the nose tackle, now going out to play defensive end. You got to remember this is a 3-4, and Johnny Jolly originally was an inside tackle who went out to play defensive end. But the success of all this is going to be dictated by whether Pickett is agile and athletic enough to play out there on the end.
You're exactly right, Hub, and you know, a couple of people that I've talked to up there in Green Bay wonder if you know, that will be the case. And there are a couple of other interesting players who come into play. Probably the most interesting, aside from Neal, who's just really a strong player, Justin Harrell, the former first rounder, who just has never been able to stay healthy. He says now he is healthy, so we'll see what happens there.
Oh, Dan, another one of the teams you cover for us, the Arizona Cardinals. You had the pleasure of speaking to Russ Grimm, soon to be Hall of Famer Russ Grimm, but he is currently the assistant head coach and offensive line coach for the Cardinals. You know, Alan Faneca obviously is a big name, a well-known name around league circles, but there are some who say he might be a liability in his 12th season in the NFL. What was Grimm's take on Faneca and what role he might play on the Cardinals' line this year?
Yeah, it was real interesting, Eric. Russ is very excited about going to Canton, he was very much in the moment and very much focused on the training camp that was just a couple of days away. And as far as Alan Faneca goes, he basically told me that he still has a lot left in the tank, particularly as a run blocker. And he discounts all these critics and thinks that Faneca is going to be a very solid addition on a line that really has undergone a lot of changes.
Dan, you know, you look at the rest of that line, and Deuce Latuhi, I think, is a player that they're excited about in his fifth year. Reggie Wells seems to have found a home. Levi Brown is a guy. I guess is the big question Lyle Sendlein?
Well, what's interesting is that he's the only real constant, because they've just made a lot of changes here. They're moving Levi Brown from right tackle to left tackle. Latuhi isn't exactly a lock. Reggie Wells, who played where Faneca is playing now, is challenging him there. So there's change all over the place, except for Sendlein, who very quietly has just gotten better and better. He showed major improvement last year after having to deal with a torn left shoulder the previous season that he kept quiet, and that greatly limited his ability to punch. But Russ Grimm really loves Sendlein. He told me, you don't start at Texas for 4 years and become the captain unless you have some kind of real toughness and mental attitude.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. You can read more of Dan's visit with assistant Cardinal head coach Russ Grimm and Hall of Famer at ProFootballWeekly.com or in the print edition of Pro Football Weekly. And we now welcome in associate editor Michael Blunda. Michael, out on the AFC West beat, at least with the Chiefs and the Chargers. Big news from the Chargers, Michael, and it's not Vincent Jackson, it's not Marcus McNeil, it's not Sean Merriman. It's Antonio Gates is the first domino to fall as he gets a $36 million five-year deal, over $20 million guaranteed, now the highest paid tight end in the NFL. Good for Gates, good for the Chargers, but what kind of impact does it have on these other three guys, two of whom are saying they're not going to be at training camp?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's what everybody's wondering. You know, these two guys looking for contract extensions get you passed up. And it seemed like all along that was with the Chargers' plan. Gates was number one on their agenda to get signed long-term. Even though his contract wasn't expiring until after this season, they went ahead and got it done, locked him up through 2015. And now everybody's wondering what they're going to do next. It looks like it could be Marcus McNeil, the guy they try to maybe negotiate a long-term deal with after this, but nothing is for sure. And that'll be one of the more interesting stories of the Chargers training camp.
Michael, following up, when you look at this Chargers roster, obviously they lost some pieces in the offseason. Jamal Williams, a longtime nose tackle. Antonio Cromartie, they traded to the New York Jets. When you look at this roster, though, I read a couple of notes from your Way We Hear It this week, and it seems like guys like Giles Tucker, who started a couple years ago, Alphonso Boone, who joined the team last year, and Kevin Burnett, who was actually a big free agent signing from the Cowboys, are these guys in danger of not making this roster despite all the deletions in the offseason?
They could be. It's going to depend on what happens in the preseason. All three of these guys were somewhat underachievers last year, especially Giles Tucker. And Kevin Burnett, he was okay, but didn't really play up to the hopes that the team had for him. He got hurt late in the year, then underwent neck surgery. And if some of their younger linebackers come through and perform well in the preseason, he could possibly be on the way out if they are having issues with the getting down to 53 men.
All right, Michael, hold on just a minute now because we want to talk to you a little bit about the Chiefs as well. But first, a quick commercial break and then more NFL Way We Hear It. We've got more NFL Way We Hear It as we continue with Associate Editor Michael Blunda. And Michael, the Kansas City Chiefs, they're a team that fascinates me because clearly Scott Pioli and then Todd Haley are brought in to completely rebuild this ball club, made a lot of roster moves last year, a lot more roster moves this year, and yet first thing that happens, they get to training camp, and three guys who should be, you know, middle-aged veteran stars, left tackle Brandon Albert, wide receiver Dwayne Bowe, you got defensive end Glenn Dorsey, the third overall pick in the draft a number of years ago, they all show up at camp out of shape.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happened last year when these guys showed up. They were all overweight, not prepared to play, and it didn't really sit well with Todd Haley, as you could expect. He made them all stay away from practice until they could pass the conditioning test. And, you know, this, certainly trying to send a message to the team that if these guys don't show up in shape, then they're not going to be able to play.
Clearly, Todd Haley has made a mission out of putting his stamp on this team, getting control of this team and getting control of his locker room. We know that late last year and even during the offseason, there were concerns about coach-player relationship. What is the mood of that locker room now as they kick off their training camp?
I think there are still some players maybe who don't love Todd Haley, his attitude as a coach, but from what we're hearing, it seems like the addition of guys like Charlie Weiss and Romeo Cannell have done a lot to let Haley maybe take a step back and take a little bit of a bigger picture approach, not be so intense with every detail of practice, be more of an overseer and let these guys get on the players while he, you know, just kind of takes a bigger look at things.
All right, Michael, thank you much. We now want to bring in Associate Editor Dan Parr. And, Dan, in Tampa Bay, they got some problems. Donald Penn is not a household name, but pretty good left tackle who they didn't want to let get away as a restricted free agent, so they tendered him the contract amount necessary to keep him. He refused to sign his tender. They are now in camp hoping this is the year that Josh Freeman becomes the franchise at quarterback, and yet his blind side is wide open, and there is no sign that Penn is going to show up soon.
Yeah, Penn's made 44 straight starts for the Bucs, and while he's not a Pro Bowler, he's done a very nice job there. They're going to need him just because they don't really have any other good options. They're going to have an open competition while he's away between DeMar Dotson, Xavier Fulton, and James Lee, who are even lesser-known players and guys who are very inexperienced, have no starting experience. And as you mentioned, Josh Freeman is a guy they expect to really take a step up. Donald Penn is under no obligation to show up. He hasn't signed his tender. They've reduced it by $100,000, and there's not much they can do. He's not under contract. They can't find him until he is under contract. This is not a holdout, but his absence could linger here for 2 to 3 weeks or so before he comes in and signs that tender. The Bucs have shown no interest in offering him a long-term deal.
Well, for my money, I think it's DeMar Dotson's job to lose if Donald Penn doesn't show up. But obviously some bigger names on the defensive side of the ball. I mean, at tackle, you know, the first two picks were big-name guys from established programs. Gerald McCoy, Oklahoma. Brian Price, the Pac-10 Player of the Year from UCLA. How have those guys, I mean, are they pretty much being pushed into that starting lineup from day one?
Gerald McCoy, I don't think there's any question. He's not under contract yet. And if for some reason this holdout lasted for a long time, which no one's predicting. He's waiting for Sam Bradford to sign before he signs, and that deal could be done fairly soon. Barring some kind of long holdout, I think Gerald McCoy will be starting three technique come week one. I don't think there's much doubt about that. Brian Price, whether he's starting or not, he'll be heavily involved as the nose tackle there on that front four. They're both going to be significant contributors and guys they're expecting to really boost that pass rush.
You know, Dan, so much of this, just the rights of late summer in the NFL as the first-round picks are the last dominoes to fall. And in Denver, we shouldn't be stunned that Tim Tebow's deal's not done, even though he was at the bottom of the first round. And yet, if there is a player in the NFL that needs training camp more than Tim Tebow, we don't know who it is. He said he didn't want to miss a single practice. He's missed the first couple days. Apparently, Brian Sanders and his agent are not far apart. And yet, you have to assume that every missed practice is like double or triple for a guy like Tebow, who is such a development project.
Yeah, he can't afford to miss a whole lot of time. The good thing is, he's probably not going to be a guy who's taking a lot of snaps at quarterback for the Broncos this year. We don't know exactly what his role is going to be, but he's missed a couple practices as we taped today, and it seems like they're getting very close. Josh McDaniels said there was nothing to report on that front today when he was asked about it. He apparently spoke with Tim Tebow today, though. It sounds like him and Demaryius Thomas, the other first-round pick for Denver, are both in town and are ready to report as soon as these deals get done. It's just a matter of time.
Very quick, Dan, and because we're almost out of time here, but I see an interesting quote from McDaniels where he says that Tebow has fallen behind the other players as they install parts of the offense. Since he's clearly not competing for a starting job, what does that really mean? Is he talking about a slash-type role for Tebow this year while he learns the quarterback position?
I think he was speaking more generally. I'm not sure if he was hinting at any kind of role they have in mind for him. I think that McDaniels has established himself as a fairly no-nonsense guy, and he's going to take a shot at players who aren't in camp and ready to go right away. And I think that was not a very serious comment, but I think that Tebow's role is something that maybe Josh McDaniels isn't exactly sure quite yet. He's going to see what he can handle first.
All right, Dan, thank you much. We take another quick commercial break, but lots more NFL Way We Hear It coming. We're back with you in just a moment. Yes, we are. A little back and forth between the studio and the producer's booth as we have some fun talking NFL training camp openings. And we now welcome in Associate Editor Arthur Arkish. Arthur has been covering the Jaguars and the Colts for us. And the side of the Jaguars, Arthur, really big news out of Jacksonville off the field. The Jaguars have a $16.6 million five-year stadium naming rights deal. It's with a Jacksonville bank, the Everbank. And, you know, by some standards, it might not be all the money in the world, but in Jacksonville, it's a big deal, mainly because they haven't even been able to sell the rights to the stadium for the last couple of years.
Well, absolutely. They're very excited about it in Jacksonville. As you mentioned, it's going to be a five-year deal, and Everbank is saying that it's going to hopefully be an even longer relationship than that. Again, they're excited in Jacksonville. Now, they do want to sort of caution the fans that while this is a step in the right direction, it certainly helps with the image of the team. You know, everyone talks about the lack of ticket sales, and they've also talked about not having a deal or naming rights deal for that stadium since 2006 when they were, of course, Alltel Stadium. Regardless, this is still a very pressing issue. They have to sell over 5,000, 5,600 general bowl seats for each game to avoid blackouts this season, and that's still not accounting for the other 5,000 that the Jaguars have agreed to put into the group ticket sales. So there's still a lot of work to be done, but it is a step in the right direction, and certainly they're excited in Jacksonville.
Well, yeah, and to put it in perspective, those 5,600 seats, I don't know what the average NFL ticket price is, but at each one of those games, it comes close to the total revenue that the $3.3 million a year stadium naming rights will give you. So still a long way to go, but a good sign. Now, another move apparently that owner Wayne Weaver has made to try and placate his fans, the two preseason games will be televised. 9 of 10 games last year were blacked out. Some people agreeing, some people saying maybe that's not such a good idea.
Right. Now, one way of looking at it, of course, is the preseason games are the ones, you know, that the fans shouldn't be paying the same price as the regular season games for. The other side of it is it's kind of almost pandering to the fans and letting them know that, you know, it's okay for you to not pay for these seats. Just make sure you're in the stadium for the regular season. And some think that's kind of sending the wrong message. So we'll just have to wait and see what kind of ticket sales are going to happen from here on out.
From the bottom to the top, we shift to the Colts, Arthur, and the Super Bowl runners-up. I mean, one of the things that struck me after that loss was Bill Polian's comments about the offensive line. He clearly singled them out as a unit that didn't carry its weight, not only in that game, but he seemed to be suggesting that it had been a problem. It looks like the line has made sort of a shift. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we all know by now the surprising release of Ryan Lilja, who had been with the team for a while at guard. He was released. He was, you know, a very solid player, but undersized. Polian is saying that they want to get bigger, they want to get stronger, they want to get more physical, they really want to be able to power block. Now, the competition is going to be wide open in training camp, but there's clearly been a bit of a change in philosophy, and they really do want to get back to a more balanced attack like they were in 2006 when they won the Super Bowl that season. They were fantastic on the ground, especially in the postseason, and they think that they need to do a little bit better to help Manning out.
So it sounds like the only guys who have any security in that line, Jeff Saturday, the center, has been there forever, and Ryan Deem at right tackle, is that fair to say?
That is definitely fair to say. Now they've got Kyle Devan, who came in and did a nice job in, I believe, 9 games last season. He's going to be in the mix. They drafted the rookie fourth rounder, I believe, Jacques McClendon. He will be in the mix. And then they've got a pair of former high draft picks in Mike Pollock and Tony Ugo, and they're hoping they're going to get a lot more out of those two guys this season, so we're just going to have to wait and see. But certainly competition is going to be fierce on the interior and really all along the offensive line and training camp.
All right, Arthur, thank you very much. We're going to get away to another short commercial break here because we've got so much more to go over right here on Pro Football Weekly with a training camp opening way we hear it as we go around the NFL. He's Eric Edholm. I'm Hub Arkish, and we now welcome in another of our senior editors, Mike Wilkening. And, Wilkie, it is good to have you back with us. I'm going to ask you to hang on for just a second as I go to Eric and talk about the Washington Redskins. They wondered, their $40 million man, who would show up for training camp, and lo and behold, it was Fat Albert, and he couldn't pass the conditioning test.
Yeah, as of this taping, Albert Haynesworth did not pass the first install. I should take that back. He passed the first segment of the conditioning drill, but then had to walk through the second part of it. So that was not good enough. The Redskins thought he was in good shape. They were told he was going to be in good shape. Mike Shanahan appeared to be I guess pleased would be the word with what he saw, but the results are in the pudding, and they were not there for Albert.
Yeah, plenty of pudding on Albert, I guess. Hey, well, here's the thing. The whole off-season acrimony started because he chose not to work out with the team over his dissatisfaction with the system and said repeatedly, I'm a pro, I'm getting paid, I'll be in shape, and here you go, first day out of the bat, he clearly isn't.
Yeah, you know, teammates at this point, very disappointed with what they've seen of the, you know, defensive leaders like Leonard Fletcher, Philip Daniels. They spoke out in June when he wasn't there at the mini camp. That was obviously the first sign of trouble. They came out with this sort of agent-driven thing that said he was happy with the new role. He was going to do whatever the coaches said. They want to play him at the free safety. I'll play free safety. But all that has been undercut by the fact that he hasn't shown up in training camp ready shape.
Well, and Mike, with the Cincinnati Bengals across the country, everybody thinks the story has to be T.O. showing up and forming possibly the unholiest trio, could be legendary in NFL standards at wide receiver. We'll get to that in a minute. Another key guy for the Bengals who showed up and couldn't pass a test.
Right. Andre Smith, their right tackle, they drafted in the first round in 2009, had his injury cut short, you know, by injury last year, a foot injury, and you know, had a long holdout before that. Well, he's going to be out at the beginning of this camp. He's on the active PUP list because of the foot, because of conditioning issues, also according to Marvin Lewis. He's somebody that might not be available, it doesn't look like, until later in camp. Marvin Lewis has also reportedly said that the possibility of Andre Smith beginning the season on the PUP list is something that could be in the cards. So obviously a very disappointing start to the summer for Andre Smith.
All right, now let's talk about the unholy trinity at wide receiver. It's exciting. It'll be fun. They won't lack for quotes, but can it work, I think, is the question, with T.O. now joining Ocho Cinco and Antonio Bryant.
And that's the $2 million question. Now, obviously, they're paying him a reportedly $2 million in salary. He can make up to $2 million more in incentives. It's clear, guys, that this is a passing offense that needed to be upgraded. It's clear they've had interest in Terrell Owens since the beginning of this offseason, when they eventually, you know, signed, you know, Antonio Bryant, and seemingly looked to have moved on without Terrell Owens. But that door opened again. We know that Antonio Bryant has been bothered by a knee issue. Now, he practiced on the first day of training camp, but, you know, his, you know, kind of where he is in terms of the health of that knee going forward remains to be seen. He's not, he's going to sit out, looks like, the second of two practices for most of the days in camp. So, look, this is a team that needs more out of its passing game. Teams were too easily able to key on Chad Ochocinco last year. If Terrell Owens can come in, not be disruptive, and be a guy that catches 50 to 60 passes, so probably be a good signing. But whether or not that happens really remains to be seen.
Eric, I look at the Philadelphia Eagles. Now, I'm not a fan of the Donovan McNabb trade, but let's assume Kevin Kolb can do it at quarterback. I'll take the Eagles wideouts over the Bengals right now. DeSean Jackson, Jeremy Maclin, Jason Avant. The question with the Eagles, and some would say, well, you know, Andy Reid doesn't care. Can they run the football? Because the bigger loss may prove to be Brian Westbrook.
I think you think about the Eagles and you say, okay, they are a 60-40 passing team. Like you said, everyone's talking about what are they going to do post-McNabb. Well, look, I mean, Brian Westbrook, even though he wasn't healthy for a good portion of last season, you know, they sort of handed the reins a little bit to LeSean McCoy, but, you know, if you remember, they ended up using Leonard Weaver in a lot of single back sets last year. I mean, he was sort of their unheralded guy. Now, they've told Weaver that he's not going to be running the ball as much, and the hope is that McCoy is going to step up into that role. Look, it took Brian Westbrook until his fifth season until he became a complete running back. I mean, he was a great receiver, had that part of his game down. I guess the interesting irony here is that McCoy's biggest weakness right now is probably pass protection, catching the football. I think the running part he's got. The full, complete back part, not sure he's there yet.
All right, Mike, very quickly in Tennessee before we run to a break. Vince Young, their starting quarterback now for sure, will not be suspended for his off-season problems, off-the-field problems, I should say. Is that enough for Jeff Fisher, though? Are they comfortable? Are they sure that they can trust this kid to be the face of their football team?
Well, it's a big positive that he wasn't suspended, but I think what everybody wants to see going forward is sort of how Vince Young conducts himself. If he can stay out of trouble in these type of incidents. And, you know, Roger Goodell, in speaking in Green Bay today, reportedly said that he talked to Vince Young kind of about his responsibility of playing in the NFL. And, quote, Goodell said, quote, he needs to avoid putting himself in that kind of position, unquote. And, again, what Goodell means is, you know, was in trouble. The incident in June in Dallas, again, was sort of ticketed, but again, that's all that came of it. No suspension for him, but again, how he acts going forward, I think, is something that everybody wants to keep an eye on.
I think that's the commissioner's favorite line, avoid putting himself in that kind of position. He said it many times about Michael Vick. That's not working out so well there. We'll see how Vince Young handles it. We've got a lot more where we hear it in just a moment. Bob Arkish visiting with senior editors at Pro Football Weekly, Eric Edholm and Mike Wilkening. And Mike, we were talking before the break about the Tennessee Titans. Vince Young will not be suspended, but maybe the bigger story out of Tennessee this week is that they have filed a lawsuit against the University of Southern California and Lane Kiffin for tampering with the contract of running backs coach Kennedy Pola. And bottom line, they appear to be right.
Well, what the Titans have charged, according to this lawsuit that was filed in Davidson County Chancery Court in Tennessee, they've alleged that USC and Kiffin, or Kiffin and USC, had Pola, you know, induced him to breach his contract with the Titans, which, according to the Titans, was that Pola basically had to seek written permission from the Titans to be able to discuss employment with other teams or, you know, at other businesses, what have you. And what happened was, from the Titans' version of it, was that Pola accepted the job, and kind of that was that. And afterwards, the anger that Jeff Fisher had was that Lane Kiffin kind of didn't follow the type of protocol that you like to see with this, where there's sort of a phone call or is reached out beforehand or something like that, the typical protocol. So I think it's a lawsuit that it'd be very interesting to see how this plays out, when it plays out. But for the time being, the Titans, you know, had a role on the staff they had to fill. They moved Craig Johnson, their quarterback's coach, to running back's coach. So, I mean, they were able to do that and promote from within, but obviously this was kind of a distraction before the start of the season for the Titans.
Well, and here's the interesting thing about the story to me, Mike. As I have followed it, Jeff Fisher lashed out, was very upset, and Lane Kiffin, as only Lane Kiffin can do, issued a very dismissive statement about, well, this is what happened, and we've taken care of it, and they understand now. But apparently he never did speak to Fisher even afterwards, and then came the lawsuit, and let's connect the dots, Jeff Fisher, a USC alum. And I get the feeling it's a lot more about Jeff Fisher and Lane Kiffin than it is about who the running back coach of the Titans is.
That very well could be the case. From a big picture standpoint, obviously what everybody wants to see is, if this plays out, how does it affect the hiring process for assistants going forward? I think that's the real importance of this if it plays out going forward.
All right, Eric, we look at the New York Giants, and in my way of thinking, at least the last few years, and it really was handed off from Ernie Accorsi to Jerry Reese without really skipping a beat. Some teams just seem to get it right. And the bottom line is that if Keith Bullock is healthy, and that's a big if, because he's 7 months away from ACL surgery, sometimes an 18-month injury, always a 12-month injury, but he knocked their eyes out in workouts, did the same with the Arizona Cardinals, who also wanted to hire him. He is a New York Giant, and he has turned a potential significant weakness into a potential significant strength for this Giants defense.
They were looking at a fourth-round pick, Philip Dillard, possibly filling the role at middle linebacker. They were looking at Jonathan Goff, a former fifth-round pick, a guy who played okay down the stretch, and a couple other sort of journeyman types. All of a sudden, you upgrade to Keith Bullock. Like you said, if he's healthy, could be a huge bonus. They're gonna put the training wheels on him in camp. They're gonna limit him to one practice a day, similar to what they're doing with Kenny Phillips. So, Coughlin said he expects both these guys, Phillips and Bullock, to be back. And you can't imagine that if the players on the team play better than what they did, adding some rookies, and now adding Bullock, Antrell Roll, getting Phillips back, this has got to be a better defense in 2010 than it was last year.
Mike, interesting story with the Pittsburgh Steelers, and I want to stop here and say on behalf of all of us at Pro Football Weekly, our thoughts and prayers are to Bill Cowher and his family for the tragic loss of his wife, Kay, who died due to skin cancer last week. And an announcement that would seem unrelated, the Pittsburgh Steelers have announced that Director of Player Personnel, Kevin Colbert, has signed a 5-year contract extension. Now, what is intriguing about this to me is several teams that I have talked to over the last 18 months who've shown an interest in Bill Cowher, who would almost certainly demand total control of an organization. The assumption has been that his very close friend Kevin Colbert is the guy that he would bring with to handle personnel. Do you think that the Steelers wrapping up Mike Tomlin basically for just 2 more years, but Colbert for 5 years, sends a message that they're pretty aware of what the significant risk was there?
What it ultimately says to me, as much as anything else, is that this is always an organization that's believed in stability. Kevin Colbert is drafted very well in round one, has built 2 Super Bowl winning teams. Mike Tomlin coached 1 Super Bowl winning team in 3 years on the job. Keeping that core together, I think, was important, and I think is very much in line with what the Steelers have done before. I mean, they typically, they value employees that perform for them and believe in stability, and this is sort of another example of that.
All right, guys, thank you very much. We've got to take one more commercial break here, but we will be back, and we'll have the Publisher's Pen coming up for you next.
And now to present the Publisher's Pen, the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Eric, thank you very much. And I wanted to talk for just a minute about a subject that we got into with Wayne Larrabee at the top of the show. Wayne, earlier this week in Green Bay, had heard Commissioner Roger Goodell speak to the Green Bay Packers annual shareholders meeting. And the great focus of that conversation was on the collective bargaining agreements and the negotiations that lie ahead. And one of the subjects that comes up every time we talk about this is the possibility of an 18-game schedule. And it is clearly a focus of Goodell's and of the owners. They call it the adjusted season, so to speak. They don't want to be too, they want to be real careful about what they talk about who it's going to cost money, who it's going to make money. But here's the bottom line on the 18-game season, two-game preseason, as opposed to the 16-4 that we currently have. It works for everybody. We don't need to preach here about how the fans feel about it. Two less preseason games, two more real games. That's going to make everybody happy. But this is one of those rare collective bargaining discussions and negotiations that clearly works for both sides. Now, the players predictably are trying to find out what's potentially wrong with it. They're trying to make sure they wring everything they can out of it. But here's the bottom line from the players' perspective. Regardless of what is eventually negotiated as the amount, the percentage of the total revenue that the players get, it is going to be increased by 2/16, or roughly 12%, by adding two more regular season games. It's a whole different venue as far as TV money, as far as how the ticket revenue gets split. And so once there is more revenue in the pot, and you're taking a percentage of it, you make more money. From the owner's perspective, they understand that too. That's why they want to do it. Now, there is talk from the owner's side, oh, but we may have to have expanded rosters, and we may have to change the IR procedure, and we have to work on conditioning, because they're now trying to throw out all the additional money it's going to cost them to do this. So while you have both sides posturing, what should not be lost is this is clearly a win-win for both sides. It is going to happen, and it's something fans should expect, either the first week of the 2011 season or when it eventually starts, if, God forbid, there is a lockout. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks to our regular host, Wayne Larrabee. He's been off during the offseason, but checked in with us from the Packers shareholder meetings in Green Bay. Randy Meyer, our outstanding engineer and producer. Our syndication networks, who are our home studio and syndicator. And most of all, our thanks to all of you for listening. We really appreciate it. Please be back with us again next week, same time, same station, for more Pro Football Weekly.